You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Thank you very much, Ken. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you all for being here tonight. I'm going to read a bit, and then we'll have a conversation with my old friend, Sergio Muñoz Bata, whom I have known for many years. When he was very young, he was known as El Filósofo. And we still call him El Filósofo because he's a Socratic figure. He proposes, he knows, but he asks at the same time. I'm very happy you're here with us, Sergio. I'm going to read from La Voluntad y la Fortuna, which is published in English as Destiny and Desire. And this is translated by a great translator, Edith Grossman, who has translated Cervantes, so how could I say no? And the old Latin, Italian saying says, traduttore, traditore, the translator, is a traitor. He has to be a traitor. There is nothing worse than a literal, faithful translation. It doesn't read well. The translation has to go into the other language in which you read it. And this is the case of Edith Grossman. She's done an English version of my book. It is the same book, exactly the same book, only it's in very good English. If I had translated, it would be very bad English. I'm going to read from this book. I'm going to read just a little bit in Spanish, since it's the original, it's my language. And it says, de noche el mar y el cielo son uno solo, y hasta la tierra se confunde con la oscura inmensidad que lo envuelve todo. No hay resquicios, no hay cortes, no hay separaciones. La noche es la mejor representación de la infinitud del universo. Nos hace creer que nada tiene principio ni fin. Sobre todo si, como sucede esta noche, no hay estrellas. Aparecen las primeras luces y la separación se inicia. El océano se retira a su propia geografía, un velo de agua que oculta las montañas, los valles, los cañones marinos. El fondo del mar es una cámara de ecos, una cámara de ecos que jamás llegan hasta nosotros y menos hasta mí esta madrugada. Sé que el día va a derrotar esta ilusión. Y si ya nunca más amaneciese, ¿entonces qué? Entonces creeré que el mar me ha robado mi figura. And I'll go on in English. Keep going. Don't applaud too much. Wait for the end. In this story, we have two main characters, Josué and Jerico. This first reading has to do with Josué, whose head is floating on a beach in the Pacific Ocean. Here is my severed head, lost like a coconut on the shores of the Pacific, along the Mexican coast of Guerrero. My head torn away like the head of a dead fetus that has to lose it so the headless body can be born in spite of everything, quiver for a few moments, and die as well, drowned in blood, allowing the mother to be saved and to cry. After all, the efficacy of the guillotine was tested first by severing the heads of corpses, not of kings. My head was cut off by machete blows. My eyes are two open beacons of astonishment until the next tide carries them out and the fish swim into my head through the sacrificial orifice, and the gray matter spills in one piece onto the sand, like an overturned bowl of soup, lost in the earth, forever invisible unless the fee is paid by national and foreign tourists. We're in the tropics, damn it. Don't you know that, you people who are still alive, who believe you're living? This is the head of Josué, the son of unknown parents, who is searching for his living body, the one he had in life, the one he lived night and he felt night and day, the one that woke every morning with a life's plan, negated, of course it was, by the image in the first mirror of the day. I, Josue, whose only concern at this moment is not biting my tongue, because although my head is severed, my tongue attempts to speak. Freed at last, and succeeds only in biting itself as one bites a sausage or a hamburger. Flesh we are, and to flesh we return. Is that how it goes? Is that the prayer? My eyes, without sockets, look for a word, the word. I was a body, I had a body. Will I be a soul? Josue is in constant relationship with another young man called Jericho, and I will have a brief introduction of him. What shall we do? What shall we do, he repeated. There are many possibilities for success. What are yours and mine? Or rather, Josue, which success is worthy of you and me? Now, we have to decide what we're actually going to do. He stood and grasped my shoulders. We didn't have, there was apparent, a talent for music, literature, tennis, water or downhill skiing, racing cars, or directing films. We didn't have the soul of actuaries, accountants, real estate agents, porters, and all the sad people who accept their small destinies. He said, what do we have left? I told him to tell me. I didn't know. Politics, Josue. It's self-evident, brother, where you are no good as a street sweeper or a composer, when you can't write a book or direct a movie or open a door or sell socks, then you devote yourself to politics. That's what we're going to do, I said with false astonishment. Josue laughed and let go of my shoulders. Politics is the last resort of intelligence. There are a couple of women, interesting women in this book. One is Lucha Zapata. She's a young woman who is a kind of damned soul, a drug addict, full of tenderness, full of love, very important character in the novel. There is Asunta Jordan, who is quite the opposite, a very tough lady who is the lover of Max Monroy, this very rich entrepreneur, which, contrary to all the reviews I've been reading in this country, is not Carlos Slim. Carlos Slim is a very serious family man. My character, Max Monroy, is a rather sinister entrepreneur. He's 80 years old. He has a lover, Asunta Jordan. He has a wife who is in a madhouse. She's crazy, but he goes and sees her and his children with her. And he has three children. Two I shall not name. I hope you read the book. And the third is called Miguel Aparecido, and he is in jail out of his own will. He is afraid that if he's let out of jail, he'll do something terrible. So this is a monologue from Miguel Aparecido. He grabbed the newspaper. Look, look, he said, poking at the image of Max Monroy and in passing that of the president of Mexico. Look, I looked. Do you know he's never allowed his picture to be taken? The president, I said. He's always in the newspapers and television. All that's left for him is to announce the lottery. Monroy, said Miguel, as if all the bitterness of the world were concentrated in that name. A yellowish saliva ran down the prisoner's lips. The tiger devoured by other bloody tigers in the Chapultepec Zoo appeared duplicated in his eyes. Monroy, motherfucker, at least he used to be discreet enough not to be photographed. Decency not to let himself be seen, the old bastard son of a bitch. I confess my discretion or my cowardice. I didn't jump at the defense of my old friend from the graveyard, the bitch mother of Max Monroy, Antigua Concepcion, whom I'll introduce in a moment. And worse, even worse, Miguel said, syllable by syllable, even worse is the son of the great bitch whore, Max Monroy's son. Who is he? I said, innocent but uneasy. This is the story Miguel Aparecido told me that afternoon in a cell of the San Juan de Aragon prison After going on a while longer in his diatribe, he asked for explanation and the unasked for one as well. I felt a strange emotion. Miguel Aparecido seemed like an hourglass, anxious to empty the contents of 1 hour into another, though anguished by the fatal flight of time. The flight of time was the evasion of his narrative, and I was his privileged listener. At that moment, I still did not know to what degree so intense, so personal was what he was telling me, how it concerned me. I thought at first he vacillated between emptiness and incoherence. I wanted to believe that at the end of the story, both of us, he who was talking and I who was listening to him, without saying a word, could find in ourselves something resembling compassion and from there pass on to comprehension, to understanding. Now this was merely a desire, or even an intention of mine. Miguel Aparecido's discourse took another direction. He said he was imprisoned by order of Max Monroy. Of course, judicial requirements had been met. Of course, he had a trial. Of course, testimony was heard and a sentence was announced. Of course, I was condemned to 30 years in prison for a crime I did not commit. 3 decades of confinement starting at the age of 20. He remembered, but in the voice of someone who, when recalling, also commemorates. He looked at me with a defiant air. I behaved well, Josue. I even made an effort. I intend to be the best inmate in the pen, punctual, hardworking, obliging, all of it contrary to my own character, cleaning toilets, removing excrement, mopping up vomit, all of it to get out of here, for only one purpose. He was about to lower his eyes, but he didn't, to kill. I want to get out to murder Max Monroy for having accused me falsely of attempted murder. And I wanted to deserve the accusation, deserve it. I got out, I prepared for the act, and now I was serious. I haunted the building. I imagined 1,000 ways to eliminate the son of a bitch. Suddenly he intuited it. He didn't find out. He just smelled that something was going on because he knew I was free. He had to have thought, what do I do to lock up this bastard again? Because he had to have realized that in this second round, either he'd kill me or I'd kill him. Miguel Aparecido was making a great effort to keep his gaze fixed on me, eyes wide open, as yellow as those of a canid race. Miguel Wolf, with the jaw strong as a padlock, arms and legs imprisoned but longing to get out and race towards his prey, but sad, afflicted by the confinement he had imposed on himself. He reveals to me now, he stopped prowling around the offices of Max Monroy, returned to prison, asked for the help of the lawyer. I want to go back to the pen, licenciado. Please have them take me back in from, take me back into jail. I beg you for your mother's sake, please save me from crime. I don't want to kill my father. If you really love Max Monroy, return me to the pen. You can do it. You have influence. Do me this favor. Save me from sin by locking me up right away. Accuse me of whatever you like. Get me out of freedom. Take away my desire to kill. Save me from myself. Put the chains of my freedom on me. I returned to prison, Josue. The lawyer invented some crime for me. I don't know which. I don't remember anymore. I think he revived the earlier sentence for reasons that escaped me. He's a shyster. He knows all the tricks. He can resurrect the dead. He can get water from a stone. But he can't erase the memory you drag behind. You drag behind you, whether you're free or in prison. I saw myself in the streets. I grew up to murder. Perhaps I'm even greater for having been abandoned. But I know that happened, but I don't forget it. I'll defend myself with my teeth, con los dientes. And finally, this is the mother of all mothers. There's another character I like very much. His name is Philo Pater. He's a philosopher, like Sergio. And he is expelled from the order because of his independence as a his independence as a thinker. Once upon a time, a man went down to hell and was received by a blonde hostess wearing a miniskirt and a little blue cap with the English phrase, "Welcome to hell." The hostess led the new arrival to a luxury suite with a king-size bed, marble bath, jacuzzi, and a summer wardrobe for night and day with labels from Madison Avenue, and sumptuous patent leather shoes, sandals, and moccasins. From there, the new arrival was led to a recreation area with an open bar and five-star restaurants along a tropical beach planted with palm trees, overflowing with stands of coconut palms and, of course, towel service. I was expecting something else of the new arrival. The hostess smiled and led him to a spot hidden in the luxuriant growth where there was a heavy iron door that the girl lifted up, allowing to escape a terrible sudden burst of flame and the vision of a lake of fire where thousands of naked creatures writhed as they were tortured by red devils with sharp-pointed tails who haunted the damned, piercing them with pitchforks and reminding them that the prison was eternal with no possible remission. The lake, the darkness, the sight of weeping and gnashing of teeth, Matthew 25:30. The place of the fire that never shall be quenched, Mark 9:43. Whoever enter here does not leave, despite heretical theories of a final redemption of souls, thanks to God's universal mercy. For if God of his infinite love, eventually he has to pardon Lucifer and free the souls condemned to hell. Anathema, let it be anathema to the devil with anyone who believes in God's mercy. This, said the hostess, is the cell of Catholics, only for Catholics, closing the metal door. Of course. Well, I was brought up a Catholic, so I know what I'm talking about. There was an angel in Mexico, the Angel of the Independence, in Paseo de la Reforma, and this angel now suddenly flies down and grabs Jericho by the neck and takes him over the city to an unknown place, which is a graveyard, and drops him there without any ceremony. I fell on my face where he threw me. Blood ran from my lips onto the grave and washed off the writing. If the angel commanded me write, present circumstances told me read. It took me some time to understand. The night was a dark fire, like the aforementioned hell of the Catholics, though the light that fell where I lay foretold the coming dawn, and the imminent sun urged me to be for a few minutes the thief of the night, that the great poem of the world, written by the living for the dead, but also by the dead for the living, confuses with sleep. Look at me, readers. Look and read with me as the dawn with its long nailed fingers tears away the nocturnal veil, and the wind of the plateau carries away the dust that covers the grave, where I lie face down, scratching to read with difficulty the description that says, finally, Antigua Concepción. And under that, in smaller letters, born and died with no date. The mystery of the stone was enough in itself. If that was the instruction of the dead woman, I immediately disputed it. The dry announcement on the grave of the so-called Antigua Concepción was Antigua Concepción, a name, a title, an attribute, a promise, a memory. Woken my spirit, animated by the adventure with the angel, a continuity of mystery. The angel had placed a seed there. The Antigua Concepción made a tree grow inside me. Somehow I felt, who was it? Who are you? I asked, lying there with no physical strength. How good that you have asked me, answered the voice of the grave. I am Antigua Concepción. My eyes showed no fear, but an interrogating amazement for which she, Antigua Concepción, must have been grateful, because she continued to speak from the depths of the earth. I am Antigua Concepción. I have waited in vain for someone to visit my grave. No one comes here. Do you know where you are? No, no, I replied, except someplace in the city. And I won't tell you where you are, promise. I promise. Keep my story to yourself. It is this. My name is Antigua Concepción, because when I was born, they baptized me Inmaculada Concepción de María, but ended up by calling me Concha, and what is worse, Conchita. Conchita, the name of a fake flamenco dancer. Concepción, the name of an afflicted virgin, ignorant of who made her pregnant and when. Ya vamos llegando a Péjamo. Su gran variedad de pájaros. Inmaculada is the name of a sanctified and blessed ass. Bah! Concepción is worse. The name of a Paraguayan who has never seen the ocean. Ha! A damn Concepcionista nun serving the panchos. The Holy Francis, not the trio of singers, los panchos. Conceiving or saying ingenious stupidities. No dogmas for me, young man. I am etymologically a heretic. I choose, not she chooses or is chosen, and least of all now at the depth of 1 meter where I lie. She sighed, and the earth seemed to tremble just a little. From the time I was a little girl, I rebelled against diminutives. Diminutives diminish, I shouted, making a fuss. You won't call a Julio Julito or my Concepción Conchita. Concha, cunt, motherfucker, she exclaimed with a strange guffaw. Ha! An Antigua. At the age of 20, I already knew what I wanted to be. I had no aptitude other than mystery, and more mystery than greatness. I married and assumed my eternal form. I stopped being Conchita. I stopped being Concepción Martínez, a decent, unmarried girl. I became Concepción Martínez de Monroy, a married woman. I wore my hair pulled back in a severe style, and put a nun's wimple on my head. I dressed in a Carmelite habit. I kept my key rings in the deep pockets of the habit. I never had to wear underclothes again. I sat on cottons. No one saw my bodily forms again, and whoever imagined them was clearly mistaken. I occupied the throne, a throne with no insignias, with a hole in the seat for my human necessities, which fell into a porcelain basis with the portrait of the president in power. Don't ask whichever one you like least. She heaved a sigh like an earthquake. I was terrified, I mean, and of some obscene finger rose from the earth. I'm telling you this so you'll know what's buried here with me, the history of Mexico, the history of the country. Our past is incarnated in my husband, General Maximiliano Monroy, an actor at every stage of the national melodrama, the civil war that lasted 20 years and cost us a million lives, not on the battlefield, but in cantina shootouts. Great guffaw came rumbling from the depths of the earth, and the finger returned to its place. A million dead in a country of 14 million inhabitants. How many of us are there now? Well, I said, well, about 120 million. I whispered into the grave, as it were, the ear of the woman I loved. Do I imagine myself telling the nun, Elvira Rios, listen, love me a lot, look, I'm one of 120 million Mexicans. Or the whore with the bee on her buttock, let yourself be fucked by 120 million Mexicans. Or the defenseless Lucha Zapata, just think, you're not alone, you're surrounded by 120 million Mexicans. My love. 120 million, exclaimed the voice from the grave. But what happened? Well, I said, health, food, sports, education. I was going to say all that. It seemed like a sacrilege to introduce statistics into a conversation with death. Though she soon refuted me. Death is the queen of statistics. Though wars tend to overburden her account. Well, I believe she winked at me from the bottom of her grave. And I believe she concluded, don't do any wishful thinking. Just try to anticipate catastrophes. Thank you. comes the interesting part.
Well, Luis, how long do we have? Okay, let's start. In 1958, you chose Mexico City to be the protagonist of a novel.
Yeah.
In 1987, in another novel, the narrator was the unborn Christopher. Now, the story is told by a severed head, the 1,000th severed head this year in Mexico. What's going on here?
What's going on is that who narrates the novel is very important for the novel. And there have been so many things that have been used and are quite exhausted. You can write a novel in the third person, you can write it in the first person, but then when that severed head tells it, it becomes a different novel. Right? When an unborn child tells it from his mother's womb, it's another story. So it's a question of, you can't escape the narrative, but how do you go into the narrative? There are many forms to do it. This is the one I chose this time, a severed head. And the severed head is in a hurry. He has only 500 pages to tell his story before he is washed away forever.
And that's in English.
And that's in English. Yes, indeed.
As I began reading the novel, I first thought it was going to be a mystery novel.
It is.
Then I read the debates between St. Augustine, Nietzsche, and Spinoza, which I liked. And that made me think that actually this was a philosophical novel. But then the narrative weaved between a detailed erotic tale and a political palace intrigue. Is the genre something that is passé in the novel?
No, on the contrary. Who proves that it is not passé is Cervantes. I think Cervantes founded the modern novel, and what did he do? He joined genres. You have almost every genre in Don Quixote. You have the epic genre, although it's a mock epic, Don Quixote. You have the picaresque novel, which is Sancho Panza. You have a bucolic narrative. You have a Mauresque narrative. You have a Byzantine tale. You have a tale within the tale, several novels that are novels within the novel. You have the whole panoply of what. That is why he founds the novel. He shows that the novel is a genre of genres. Then into a novel you can put absolutely everything or practically everything. You know, this instance of the history of the novel personified by E.M. Forster and the aspects of the novel, which is no. A novel should be a very direct, simple thing. It should have a plot and characters. Only a plot and characters? No. It has a million things more to go into it, as Cervantes proved, as James Joyce proved, as everybody that has written great novels has proven. The novel is safe from the limitations of the essay, from the greatness of the poem. It is not a philosophical debate, but it has a story, it has characters, it has narrative, it has journalism, it has epic, it has picaresque, it has everything Cervantes wanted it to have. Let us recover the whole potentiality of the novel. That is why this novel is written the way it is, as a humble admission that the novel is always more than it can be or more than it can say.
I know Balzac is one of the heroes in your pantheon.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's also Cervantes and Proust and Dickens and Dostoevsky and Faulkner and then some more. But the parallels between your work, your maybe 24 novels, your I don't know how many essay books, and Balzac's are remarkable. Can you elaborate on this influence?
Well, Balzac died at 50 from exhaustion, and I'm still here. Thanks to Sylvia. But, the fact is that writing keeps you alive. There are people who retire, I say, where to? Where people retire to? I don't understand that phrase, because I think that if you're a writer, you always have something more to say. You're always wanting to go beyond what you have done and reach another limit. So the comparison to Balzac is very flattering, because Balzac in 50 years wrote the human comedy. He wrote a vast fresco of the 19th century France, of Europe, of post-Napoleonic Europe, which is what, in a way, what many novelists attempt. I think Faulkner really writes the great vision of the south of the United States. García Márquez gives us a great vision of South America and 100 Years of Solitude. It's not obligatory, but there are writers who attempt this vast fresco, and I'm no exception. I really have wanted to give a sensation of the life of Mexico and the life of the past, present, and perhaps even the future with a big interrogation of Mexico. But I'm very preoccupied by my country, I'm very preoccupied by Latin America, and therefore I'm preoccupied with the world, and that sets the pace of the novels, which is what you're really referring to. Why do you keep on writing? Because I feel that I've hardly said anything as yet. But I still have a couple of years to do it. I'm sitting here with you thinking of the next novel, with a wonderful audience as well. So,
in the last 124 pages of Destiny and Desire, the plot thickens.
You bet.
With surprising revelations.
Don't tell them.
Thus, it's really hard for me to talk about it without selling the plot.
Don't do that.
Nevertheless, I have a few questions before getting into your life.
Don't do that.
On page 68, you write, quote, "In childhood, freedom is identical to imagination." And what you mean is that in childhood and in freedom, everything is possible. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate?
Yes, I think we've all been children. I guess nobody was born at 40. But there is a great nostalgia for childhood. I think we all have it, whether we admit it or not. Because the 10, 12 years that we're granted as children decide our later lives. We're always coming. I'm writing an essay of autobiography, which I had never done. García Márquez wrote a very good book of his childhood. And then he said, "Now I have reached the publication of my first book. What should I do? What can I say?" I said, "Don't say it. The book says it. 100 Years of Solitude is the book that tells you what you did after you were a child." So I only go to my 22nd year in this biography, but I dwell a lot on my childhood. My childhood was in a way privileged and eccentric because I was the son of a diplomat and I grew up in many parts of the world. I grew up in Washington, in Santiago de Chile, in Buenos Aires. I had many experiences. I'm trying to tell about them, but what comes back with the utmost force is the sense of being a child, of having the freedom to imagine, to live, to think what would be or not be. It was extremely formative, what you read as a child, the movies you saw, the music you heard, your relation with your parents, your relationships with your friends, your relationships with other little girls. You tried to violate them when you couldn't. All these things form you very, very much. They decide who you're going to be, even if you don't want to be it. Sometimes you betray your own destiny. You can't completely. You're always coming back to these formative years, which are unadulterated in a way. They're the years of your purity. Maybe I'm romanticizing childhood because it's all very, there are also many mean things about childhood. But even with the mean things, I think we would not be who we are without the glory of being children.
Okay, let's move to that day in the 1930s.
Yeah.
When you went to the movie theater in Washington, D.C. and discovered that even small children like you could make money in the movie industry. Do you remember what you did?
Yeah, my father was a big film fan, so he took me to the movies twice a week. I remember the Tivoli, the Savoy, and the RKO Keith in Washington. And there was a year, 1938, I think it was, when Joan Crawford and Katharine Hepburn were declared box office poison. And movies, the box office fell. So to bring it up, they gave you little questionnaires when you left. It was a questionnaire for children, which I took, filled it up. And to my great surprise, I won first prize, $50, which is an enormous sum. My father said, "Don't touch that money." He put it in the bank for me. It's still there. But I said, "Hey, there's money in movies." So I have become addicted to movies, but you know, very selectively. I'm writing a book called Pantallas de Plata, which is a book about movies, but I suddenly realized that I am limited to movies made between 1930 and 1950. I don't go beyond that. I can't go, maybe a Rossellini and a Buñuel and a Bergman here and there, but you can tell me what the cast is of Manhattan melodrama. Clark Gable, Myrna Loy, William Powell, Leo Carrillo. There I know everything about that, but only about that. It's a very selective attitude towards movies. But movies have another sense for me, because I was in a school, a public school in Washington, and I was well-liked, and I was part of the gang. And suddenly an event happened, which was the nationalization of oil in Mexico by President Cárdenas in 1938. And then suddenly I ceased to be popular. I was a Mexican. They told me, you are not part of us, you are a Mexican. So I said, great. I discovered my own identity. So I went to a movie where they were showing called Man of Conquest with Richard Dix and Gail Patrick. And it was a movie about the independence of Texas and Sam Houston. And as the movie developed, I got up in my seat. I was 10 years old. And I said, Viva Mexico, mueran los gringos. My father said, shut up. I'm going to lose my post and hold me out of the movie. So there's this whole question of distance and proximity to your own country, which defines your own nationality. You can lose it, you can lose that identity, or you can underline it, as I did.
Let me ask you something about that. You went to elementary school in D.C.
Yeah.
You learned English as a child.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel the temptation to write in English instead of Spanish?
Oh, yes, it was horrible. You know what happened? That I wrote, and suddenly the chandelier clinked, clink, clink, looked up, and there was Henry James saying, down. I continued, and suddenly the curtains started moving. William Faulkner came and said, I said, no, my God, what is the question? The question is that English has an uninterrupted tradition. Everything that you can say has been said and can be said in English, where Spanish is a strange language because it produces probably the founding novel of the Western world, which is Don Quixote, and then there are no other novels until Galdós and Clarín in the 19th century. So I feel there was this void in which you had to do something to say what had not been said. And curiously, this was the common ground where I met my contemporaries, García Márquez, Vargas Llosa, Cortázar himself, where our purpose at that time with those novels of the so-called boom of Latin American literature was to say what had not been said. This is not a problem for the writers today, because what has not been said has been said. And they have a lot of new things and new problems to... I was at the Paris Book Fair with my wife about 2 years ago, and it was devoted to Mexico. And only those writers who had been published in France, in French, were invited. There were 47 Mexican writers published in France who had been invited. When I was a young man, there was only Rulfo Paz and myself, only three. Suddenly there were 49. Fantastic. So, I mean, there's a growth of literature, a growth of thematic, of subject matter, and well beyond what we attempted in a way achieved, because I think we wrote interesting novels in our time, but with a very clear purpose. We said, what about this that has not been said? What has not been said about the Mexican Revolution? Huh? What has not been said about the exploitation of the banana in Colombia? What has not been said about the destiny of Peru? And what has not been said about the relationship of Argentina with Europe, etc.? And we wrote these novels. Now it is a different time, a different climate, and new novelists. But I think there is a continuity, because we did not have good novelists in the 20th century in Latin America, with one great exception, who was a Brazilian writing in Portuguese, Machado de Assis. The rest were kind of imitators of Zola and Balzac, rather mediocre novelists, great poets, especially Rubén Darío, Pablo Neruda, Vallejo. But I think that this was important because these poets gave us our language. They redeemed our language. We took back our language. And then, after the example set by Borges and Carpentier and Juan Rulfo, we could write the novels we wrote. So there's a sequence here. There's an interesting traditional sequence.
Once upon a time, you were blacklisted and you couldn't get a visa to come to the U.S. Why were you on the list, and who else was there?
I know who else was there, and I would be telling names, which is what should not be done.
Which we all know.
I don't care. I won't tell you. But the fact is, you know, I was invited by NBC to debate Richard Goodwin, who was the Undersecretary of State for Latin America with President Kennedy. And I said, well, I'll go. I'm going to lose because he's better informed. He speaks better English, but I'll go and defend the colors of the country, whatever. But when I arrived and asked for the visa, I was denied the visa. And I asked why. I said, we don't have to give you a reason. We're not giving you the visa. So once you get into that blacklist, you can't leave. And I was there for a long time until Senator Fulbright in the Senate came up with a very bizarre Kafkian solution. I ask for a visa, they deny me the visa, but when I ask for the visa again, I get the visa, which was my present state until that McCarran-Walter Act dissolved in the mists of history. And now I come here and I'm sitting with you. You are.
That's great. Well, I'm going to name names. García Márquez was on that same list. And he too came out of it. And that reminds me of a time when you and Gabo were in Cape Cod and you spent a weekend with President Clinton at the house of Bernard Jordan.
Bill Styron.
Huh? Oh, the Bill Styron. Bill Styron. And that night, Gabo told me that President Clinton was quoting by heart large passages of Faulkner's Light in August.
But you know, an American president, certain American presidents can have a read. And they do. I shouldn't have said that. Anyway, Clinton is a great reader. This was interesting because we were there with him and asking him questions. For an hour, he said, this and Mr. President, this and this and that. He said, hey, you're asking me a lot of questions. I want to ask you questions. Tell me a very simple thing. What is your favorite novel, each one of you? Bill Styron immediately said, Huckleberry Finn. García Márquez said, The Count of Monte Cristo. He said, well, The Count of Monte Cristo, the greatest novel? Yes, he said, because it is a novel of education. You take an ignorant sailor from Marseille, put him in jail with the Abbé Faria. He comes out knowing 3 dead languages, 7 living languages, high mathematics, finance, everything. Knows everything. And I was going to say the truth. I was going to say Don Quixote, but I bit my tongue because Clinton was there. And I said, Faulkner, Absalom, Absalom. Wow, I shouldn't have said it. He went into this extraordinary spiel about his life in the South and the difficulties of living in the South and the way he found himself by going to Oxford, Mississippi and reading Faulkner and being in the place of Faulkner. And then, boom, he quoted from Absalom, Absalom at length. And he knew almost everything about Faulkner and about writing. He's a very well-read person. He has to keep it silent because they wouldn't elect him if they knew it. That is the problem. That is the question. But he also said, don't think I only read Faulkner. I also read popular writers like Talbot II. I say, who? This is a writer we've never heard of, Talbot II. Yes, Paco Ignacio Talbot II. Okay. Interesting man, Clinton.
How long do we have? I have 5 minutes? Okay. Or 5 questions?
Five questions.
The so-called literary boom was a 60s phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And yet, 50 years later, you, Vargas Llosa, and García Márquez seem to be the only well-known writers outside of Latin America, well-known, well-translated. Why is it so hard for new Latin American writers to be known in the United States?
I'll tell you why, because this country has lost interest in foreign writing to a great deal. I was originally published by Forrest Strauss. Roger Strauss published Mauriac, he published Sella, he published the new Italian writers, Dino Buzzati, many, many writers from Europe. Today, that would not be conceivable. If a writer is not established and doesn't sell a modicum amount of books, he will not be translated. It's a very inward-looking country today, and it reflects on the literary scene where many, many interesting writers are not being published in the United States. They're being published in France. They're being published in Italy. They're being published in Mongolia, but not in the United States. It's something that should be corrected. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, would you share with the audience how do you write? I was very impressed. I was so lucky. A long time ago, like 40 years ago, I came to his house in London for dinner and stayed there for 3 months.
The man who came to dinner.
And and that was quite an experience. And perhaps what impressed me more is that when I woke up to go to school, he was already awake and writing. And I had never seen a Mexican so disciplined in my life. Never. And I haven't, still. But I think, what, if you would like to tell the people, how do you work? How are you able to produce 24 novels, etc.?
At the beginning of your writing life, you're terrified by the blank page, as everyone is. Huh? I'm going to be a writer. There's a blank page staring at me. What do I say? But with time and, you realize that there's a method in the madness of writing. And for me, everyone has his own experience in this. My experience is that before I go to bed, I write down a piece of paper. Tomorrow, I'm going to do this chapter, and this is happening. I've prepared a page or two with my work for the next day. I go to sleep. Wake up in the morning. I have my breakfast. I do my breakfast myself. Sylvia gets up very late. And I say, okay, now I'm going to write. Suddenly I start writing and I say, but I hadn't thought of this. This had never occurred to me. Where does this come from? There is the basic idea I had the night before, but suddenly it's invaded by things I never thought of before. They come from dreams. They come from self-hypnosis. They come from the fact that I took a shower. I don't know. But a million things. I would say that at least 70% of the page is new. It's a total novelty for the writer, and that is what gives the page a certain vibrancy, I guess, a certain vitality that even the writer doesn't know exactly what he is doing. The general lines are there, of course, but the novelties are so great that they astound you. You really do not know where it comes from, and it's very gratifying.
When you read it.
When I write it.
It's when you read it. Well, for the readers. Now, two more questions very fast. Do you read your work in translation?
I'm forced to sometimes, but I can only read myself in French and English. What they publish in the Ukraine, I have no idea. Let me tell you, I was invited to the Soviet Union in the time of Khrushchev, and I arrived and said, we have a surprise for you. I said, what? And they say, we have translated your book, The Death of Artemio Cruz. Oh, that's great. And where is the book? Here it is, a slim volume of 40 pages. I said, listen, the book had almost 500 pages. Did you put it on the diet? What happened to this fucking book? Said, no. We did you a favor. What favor? Said, we cut out all the immoral parts. I'm astounded at 40 pages left. 40 pages. They had censored the book and thought they had done me a great favor. I said, you can't do that. He said, oh, yes, we can. And this is the way to reach the Soviet reader. My God, imagine what a criterion, huh?
Amazing. Okay, the last question before we turn to the audience. What is your next novel about?
Oh, I can't talk about it because I tell you I wouldn't write it. It's very simple. You never write about what you're doing, to talk about what you're doing or what you're going to do, because my experience is that it dies right there. You can only talk about what you have already done. And so I can talk about La Voluntad y la Fortuna, but not about the coming novels. Yeah,
There is a section in the book that reminded me very much of Buñuel, and I know how close you were to Buñuel. Yeah. And that's the part where he speaks about poverty. And actually it's Jericho who's telling Josué about poverty, and he says some tough things that I believe I heard in Los Olvidados. And I was wondering if that was your inspiration.
Well, you're going to quote me?
If you know it by heart, you can say it. Otherwise, I have it here, somewhere in this mess, because I had to change everything. Oh, okay. Yeah. On page 80 in English, Josué quotes Jericho, quote, "The worst commonplace of sentimentality was to think the poor are good. It wasn't true. Poverty is a horror. The poor are damned by their submission to fatality and redeemable only if they rebel against their misery and become criminals."
It's a point of view. I'm not sure I share it completely. It's in the voice of a character, of course. And by saying this, novelists get away with murder, you know. I don't say it, a character says it.
A character, no?
Yeah. But there is, of course, an element in that evil exists in all classes, everywhere. Buñuel made it very explicit in Los Olvidados. But then you see the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie, and there in the other end of the social spectrum, even worse things are happening. So what really impressed me about Buñuel was, you know, I had the great privilege of, when he was in Mexico, every Friday from 4 to 7, I went to his house. And I talked to him and heard him, most of all, because he was the history of culture of the 20th century. It's very funny because there was the bookcase and with all these phone books. I said, God, what a lot of phone books he has. Then I saw behind the phone books were the novels of Thomas Hardy and George Meredith, which he wanted to film, but nobody would give him the money to film English novels of the 19th century. So this was a man of vast culture, but who had to disguise it a bit between his gruff Aragonese thing. And a great artist, meaning in all his work, from the very beginning, from An Andalusian Dog, and right down to The Object of Desire. He creates a whole universe, a whole universe. It is the anti-Bergman universe. Buñuel was a Catholic. He said, I believe in God in spite of myself, or something like that. He was very conscious of the Catholic roots of his atheism. Bergman is very conscious of the Protestant roots of his own rebellion against religion. Which is an interesting thing, because I think I am part of a Catholic world. Finally, I'm educated in that world. I rebel against it. I criticize it. I accept it. There are many complex relations between the man and his religion, and Buñuel was a prime example, really, of that. What you were asking something else, weren't you? Yeah, were you?
No.
He's very good.
That was the perfect answer. And now I think it's turn for the audience to ask a question. Please, sir. Yeah.
Señor Fuentes, I've enjoyed your novels over the last 40 years, I think, starting with The Death of Artemio Cruz. And I just wanted to know if you can comment on what's going on in the Middle East, the heroic people of Egypt and the other Middle East countries that are...
It's something that was totally unexpected. At least I have a friend who's very immersed in the Arab world, the Spanish novelist Juan Goytisolo. And when I called him after the events in Egypt, very surprised, because I had no inkling of what was going on, he said, well, you know, of Latin America, I only speak about Cuba because I know nothing about the rest. It was his way of saying, you don't know anything about the Arab world, which is true. And even though part of our inheritance is Arab, I don't think we were aware, many of us were not aware, that there was a whole generation of young people who were influenced by Twitter and Facebook and all the modern communications media, which is at the bottom of what happened. The government had no possibility of controlling the access. Perhaps it didn't even know there was this access of the younger people in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and the whole northern tier of Africa and the Middle East, that these people were getting information, that there were 15, 20, 25, 35 years old. They were getting a new vision of the world, a new kind of information. It was totally at odds with Mubarak and the guy, this kind of clown who fell in Libya. What's his name? I forget. They had no reality. The youth and the society were at odds with the official vision of the world. And this is what happens when revolutions start. That one is the thing that people know and feel, and another thing is the official version of events. And when the two clash, you get a revolution, which is what is happening in that part of the world. Wonderful. I'm very happy.
This whole idea about Buenas noches.
Buenas noches.
This whole idea about a severed head telling a story kind of reminds me of like a ghost story. I know Juan Rulfo was very influential to you. Remind me of Pedro Páramo. Can you talk a little bit about like this fascination that we have with ghost stories and the voices of the dead and how that, you know, influences your work?
Well, I've read ghost stories all my life, not only Juan Rulfo, who was a good friend of mine and who wrote probably the greatest Mexican novel that has ever been written, Pedro Páramo. But there he uses the dead to speak, which is a very Mexican and a very universal thing. And I was very influenced from the beginning of my life by ghost stories. There's an interesting fact about this country, which is the country of optimism and good feelings and the pursuit of liberty and freedom and happiness. And it is that all of its writers are negative. There isn't a good American writer who's not a pessimist, beginning with Nathaniel Hawthorne and ending with Jonathan Franzen. They're all saying, life's terrible, the situation is terrible, we have to do something about it, which is precisely what novelists do. This is what Pedro Páramo, Juan Rulfo did. Rulfo closed a cycle of Mexican writing, which was the novel of the revolution and the agrarian novel. After Pedro Páramo, how could you set a novel, at least for the time being, let's say, in the countryside with a ruling cacique? He did it so well, so powerfully. So I said to Juan, I told him, listen, Juan, you forced me to write a novel of the city because this has not been done in Mexico. So the whole spectrum that goes from Mariano Azuela, Martin Luis Guzman, Rafael Muñoz, to Agustín Yáñez and Juan Rulfo covers that wonderful, extraordinary period of Mexican history, which is based in the land. But now you know that more than 50% of Latin Americans live in cities. They have abandoned the land in a way. And so I had this feeling that what you had to do was to write a novel about the land. Of course, I was very influenced by antecedents like USA, a Manhattan transfer, John Dos Passos. But I still felt that Mexico City deserved a novel. That's why I wrote La Región es Transparente. Today it is a story of the village because the city has grown so much. When I wrote that novel, Mexico City had 5 million people. Today it has 22 million people. When I was born, Mexico had 20 million people. Today the country has 120 million people. So the city is a different city. I used to be able to walk it and love it and come and go with great... I came out of a cabaret at 3 in the morning. I could walk home today. I wouldn't dare. And so it's a big change. What you can do today is write novels about certain parts of the city, like Juan Villoro, who does it very well, or other writers. And you cannot do a total novel of the city, A Hand of Manhattan Transfer, again. I had that chance, but now it's gone because you have to write about partial aspects of one of the global metropolises, a city as big as Tokyo or Sao Paulo, a very complex, difficult, ugly and beautiful city, which I love and hate at the same time, which keeps me writing, of course.
By the time that he was writing La Región Más Transparente, he could tell the dialect that people from this colonia, this neighborhood, this barrio, spoke. By hearing them, you'd say, oh, that's from Colonia del Valle. Oh, that's from Coyoacán. Oh, that's from this and that. That's how he did his research.
There was somebody who knew this better than I. It was a wonderful writer who has recently died, Carlos Monsiváis.
Yeah.
We were in Venice, of all places, sitting in the Piazza San Marco, and there were lots of Mexicans coming around, and he said, you know, he is from Colonia Tacubaya. I said, what? He is from Colonia de los Doctores. What? How do you know that? Say, well, look at, hear them, the way they talk, the language they use.
Maureen. Yeah.
Buenas noches, señor Fuentes.
Buenas noches,
señor Bata. I'm gonna have to disagree with you, Mr. Fuentes. The greatest Mexican novel is La Muerte de Artemio Cruz, in my opinion. And to go back to your comments regarding genres and books, whenever I want to delve deep in the heart of Mexican history, I pick up Fuentes. Because it seems to me that your books speak to the Mexican and tell them a history or a version of history that sometimes is a little bit more satisfying than what you have in history books. Would you care to comment about...
So what is your question?
Would you care to comment about your style of bringing that history to the Mexican?
Listen, I think that every novelist has his history surrounding him and expressing itself in some way. Faulkner has the history of the South of the United States. John Dos Passos takes on the whole continent. Hemingway sees the American abroad. There's always a relationship, Balzac and France, Galdós and Spain. You can't avoid that. There's that and something else. If there's only that, it could be a guidebook. But it has to be something else. You are set in a country, in an age or whatever, but you bring to it a passion, a questioning especially. And what you're referring to is the questioning quality of a novel. There are official discourses, and we know what they are, etc. But every novelist asks questions that are not being asked publicly, that have to be asked. And this is, I think, very bracing in the work of a novelist. What is not being said? What is absent from the public discourse? What is not in newspapers? What? Is it this? Then I write it. So most novels are about what you don't see in the newspapers or in the public speeches, etc. They are the hidden part, the underwater part of a society that suddenly comes afloat and becomes central to that society through the art of the novel. And this is what has happened traditionally. And this, I hope I'm doing this as well. Thank you.
I think that was a wonderful question, and I agree with you. If you want to learn about France, you read Balzac. If you want to learn about Mexico, you read Fuentes.
Good evening, Señor Fuentes.
Hi.
Earlier, you commented a bit about how difficult it is for Mexicano literary writers to break through on the international stage in terms of their writing and their craft, their work.
Not the American writers, I meant. Not only Mexican.
Specifically. Yeah. What is your thoughts in terms of...
Is my what?
What are your thoughts in terms of the writing that you've seen in terms of Chicano writers who identify as Chicanos, who for some reason can't make that same breakthrough in Latino America and have a very difficult time making that same breakthrough domestically? That's my first question. My second question is, what would your advice be to writers who identify as Chicanos who struggle with making that breakthrough here in journalism and in writing?
Well, to answer your first question, there is a kind of prejudice, let me say it clearly, and with shame. There's a kind of prejudice against Chicano writers because they say, oh, they write in English, do they write Spanish, what is it? They don't understand the essential ambiguity of this writing, the fact that it is a frontier writing that is set right in the frontier of a land which we could call Mexamerica, which is another country, a country that requires an imagination. And I think the Chicano writers, Rolando Hinojosa, all the writers I know, give you that very powerfully. But there is, I admit it, a prejudice or reserve against these writers in Latin America because they're not fully-fledged Spanish language writers. But they're doing something else. Probably they are more cosmopolitan than we are. Probably they are foreseeing the coming world of multipolar, multicultural realities. Probably they saw it before we did. I don't know yet. It is something that has to be decided. You see, there is a prejudice against the writers. I, for one, many others try to combat it. The difficulty is great because they write in both languages. The difficulty grows less when they write in only one language. Take the case of many Puerto Rican American writers or Cuban American writers who write in English, and they get through to the American public. Do they get through to the Latin American public less than they do to the American public? So it's a complex question. It has a lot to do with evolving realities, with evolving trends, with our capacity to receive the other. We are biased against the other. We try to think that we are the best, that our realities are the only realities. And suddenly we're faced with a world that is changing so much. Listen, there's a great resistance in the United States to the new world that is emerging. Why? Because the United States was one country fighting another big country, the Soviet Union. Then it was alone. For about a decade, it said, hey, we are the great power. But suddenly you are challenged by China, which used to be a third world country, India, Brazil, where are they? Not even by Europe, but by emerging third world countries. So it's a new reality. It is forming. What is happening in the streets of Cairo and Tunis and Libya show that it is a new world of which I know very little. I'm watching with great expectation, with great interest, a world that is forming itself, and we are part of that world. And the Chicano community is part of that world. And it'll have a voice, and it'll be accepted and understood much better as the world changes. It won't be an exceptional event, but a universal event.
I think we have two more questions.
Buenas noches, señores. Señor Fuentes, muchas gracias por estar aquí.
Ande.
I wanted to say that Los Angeles has been called one of the greatest Latin American cities in the world. It's one of the cities that has the most Spanish speakers, of course, less than Mexico City, but more than most other Latin American cities. What do you think, and of course there's a whole generation of those of us who were born here and have lived here and are bilingual, bicultural, you addressed Mex-America, as you just called it. How do you think that's changing Mexican national identity to have that, and American national identity, to have what you called Mex-America, to have cities like Los Angeles, to have those of us who are fluent in both languages, who live in both languages, who live in both cultures? How do you think that's influencing?
Listen, Mexico is a very hermetic country, very hermetic. You see a lot of American publicity on the roads, drink this, wear that, cola culture. But very few Mexicans actually speak Spanish. And the traditions of Mexican customs, lovemaking, cuisine, memory, history are privy to Mexicans. They're very difficult to change, to break through. Whereas, let me be very frank, perhaps unpopular, where Spanish-speaking people in the United States are saying, this used to be ours. They have, a lot of them have that vision. It isn't true, of course. This is a great country. It has its unity. It has its variety. And one of the varieties of the strands in United States culture is the presence of Hispanic people. But they tend to preserve their cuisine, their customs, their language more than the equivalent presence of North Americans in Mexico. How this is going to blend into the great melting pot of the United States has to be seen. Because the difference, of course, is that former migrants came across the ocean and the new migrants come across the border. And it's a big difference. They're very near. They go back. Their families are there. They don't forget Mexico. Yet I believe that in the end, Mexican-Americans have to accept the fact that they're citizens of this country, that they must obey the laws of this country while enriching this country with language, with memory, with all that Mexican-Americans bring, but in the status of citizenship within the United States and political participation within the political system of the United States and not the political system of Mexico. I think it's a very simple proposition, really.
Okay, the last question.
Carlos, this is Miguel, Michael Silverblatt. I look forward, it's wonderful to see you.
Thank you.
I've heard you speaking of the ninis, the young people who are neither students nor workers, do you look to them for a revolution of the sort that we see forming in the Middle East?
No, the situation in Mexico is very different because Mexico has had a revolution. You can only have one revolution, really. And Mexico lives off the inheritance of a revolution, betrayals of the revolution, affirmations, etc., etc. But the revolution still illuminates the history of Mexico. The event in Mexico is that half our population is 30 years old or younger. And what are we offering them in the way of opportunities, studies, work, presence in the society? Some of them are very impatient because they don't see anything coming. And sometimes they go with the drug lords and they go into crime. I think the most urgent thing politically that you'd have to do in Mexico is to create a kind of, what would I call it, a Mexican New Deal. Something comparable to what Roosevelt gave this country without necessity of blood flowing or arms raising. And that is to really offer the young people of Mexico all that we have to do. We have so much to do in Mexico. We have urban renewal, ports, communications, medicine, health, education. We have a panoply of problems that we are trying to solve, but not with the energy, the force, the imagination, the sense of country that we need. This is something that Cárdenas had in his moment, for example. And we need that again in Mexico, because we have a lot of young people who are very impatient and who need a channel for this vast energy. I don't think they're only getting a piecemeal today. They should be part of a movement as strong as the New Deal was in the United States to bring all the force of the young people of Mexico into a channel of creativity, simply, of creating a new country and solving the problems we still have in Mexico, which are very great and which need an extraordinary effort and an extraordinary participation, especially of the younger people in Mexico. Thank you for the question, which I think is the last one.
Yes, I'm so sorry to say that all good things must come to an end, and this is it for us. Thank you so much, Carlos. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.